Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
All right. Live from the gleaming and streamlined state-of-the-art studios of OutlawRadioLive.com, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area. Following program produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network. Standard of a beleaguered and tempest-tossed broadcast industry. I am the legendary Burl Bear, man right there. Mark Boyer, fact-checker extraordinaire and co-host. Hey, did you hear about the big heist here in Los Angeles on Easter?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. $30 million in cash. That's real negotiable currency.
Cashish.
One of the largest cash heists in Los Angeles history. Thieves made off with as much as $30 million Easter Sunday. San Fernando Valley Money Storage Facility. Burglary occurred Sunday night in Sylmar. Cash from businesses across the region is handled and stored. Yes, stored all right, stored in somebody's pocket. Thieves were able to breach the building as well as the safe where the money was stored. Law enforcement sources said, gee, this burglary was a big one.
You think?
Yeah. Mystery surrounds the break-in.
Uh-huh.
Sources familiar with the investigation said law enforcement is stymied.
Yeah, well, they haven't figured out the diamond or jewelry heist.
No, they haven't figured that one out either.
We have our guest.
Is our guest there?
Yes, he is. Punch, welcome back.
Hey
there.
For having me.
There is the man who knows more about this than any human being on the planet.
Other than the guys who did the robbery.
Probably more than the guys who did it. This is Punch Stanimirovic, a brilliant retired Jim Heist mastermind and co-author of a book you should buy immediately, Stealing Manhattan. Now, when I heard about this heist, I went, oh my God, this is almost identical to a heist that Punch did in New York State back in, 1990s? You said to me, why rob an armored car when you can rob the place the armored car takes the money to?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened in San Fernando Valley. Yeah, that's a money storage unit, a facility, and that's something that I would target if I was still an active criminal. But we all know that I retired.
Now, when you did your version of this, how did you do it? And we have Mark has many questions for you on this. He was bugging me with questions all the way to the show. I said, you got to ask Punch.
Yeah. Well, my phone's been ringing off the hook since Easter, almost every institution has been trying to, land me for a lie to explain what basically transpired. These guys, they had inside information because it's very simple. If I had something like this, it's those people that know about the $30 million. And there was a security guard that was not named. They asked him about the heist, and he was not even aware about the $30 million. And the guy works in the place. So that is very easy to investigate and to answer any questions because this was 100% inside job.
Oh, yeah.
100%. 100%. And, the way they did it is exactly the way we would do it through a burglary method going through the
roof. The way they did it.
The ceiling.
They came in through the roof on this one then hit the safe.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was a storage facility.
Are you still there, Punch?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You there?
Yes, he's there.
Are you there?
Absolutely.
Punch is there.
I don't hear him.
I'm here.
Oh, there you are. Okay, okay. Right. Now, one of the questions Mark wants to ask you is...
I got lots of questions.
Lots of questions. Go ahead, ask him a question.
All right, let us start with the first one. You just said it has to be an inside job. Somebody has to be able to disarm the alarm system.
No. The alarm system was avoided because they went through the roof. So they didn't, they counteracted the alarm system by going through the roof.
Really?
They avoided a major zone. There's five zones, usually, with something like this, and they evaded a major zone to get to the facility. So, you know, it would look like it was by mistake, a false alarm.
Okay.
That's what it would look like.
If they took $30 million, let's say they took $30 million, how much, how bulky, what kind of size are we talking about? Is it a refrigerator? Is it a giant sub-zero? How much space does that take up?
It's a van. They need a van, and they might need a truck for that. You know, it all depends what the nomination is. If it was hundreds, they can use a van to transport $30 million. If it's in lower denomination, then you need a truck, you know. So this is a monumental task, the amount of money that was stolen. And it would take a long time to transport that much weight and that much cash.
So they couldn't have taken it back up through the hole in the roof.
That would be more difficult.
Yeah.
But as I said, I'm not really familiar with the whole entire investigation on how they exited and, how they entered. I know how they entered. I just don't know how they exited, if they exited the same way.
There is a large hole on the side of the building that's boarded up with rubble underneath it.
Yeah, that would look like an escape route. You know, that would look like a way out, or I would like to find out more where was that attached to, you know, and they fixed it, by now, you know, they fixed it, but that was, big evidence leading to, you know, how they escaped. You need a lot of space to move that type of currency.
So
okay? It's something that's not going to go unnoticed.
This is something from your bailiwick. This had to be meticulously planned.
Yes. Yeah. They used a crew of professional burglars. This is something that I would absolutely love to be involved with if I was still an active criminal. And this was done meticulously. It was well planned. They got away. It's historical in nature. They're going to make movies based on this San Fernando Valley cash grab.
There was previously a Brinks semi with $100 million in jewelry that was broken into and robbed.
Yes, I'm familiar with that.
But that kind of tangible material isn't disposable, to coin a word, quickly. You need another professional who is able to, say, move the material and get you money back for what you stole. So you're not going to get the full price for the Rolex, but you're going to make money. And this is a fence. Now, some of this material can be traced. I have my father's gold Citizen watch.
Okay.
And I have a serial number on it, and it's registered, and I can trace it if it ever got stolen. But this kind of volume of cash Does the company do anything to tag some of the money so if it's ever spent, they can find it?
There are ways to tag money. Just, we're speaking about $30 million. It's nearly impossible. It's too much. It's too big. Too large of a
fee. So, if the bill...
I don't know whose money it was or who it belonged to, but their serial numbers, they're supposed to be serial numbers on the, on the money. That's something they need to log in. We don't know who owned the money. We don't know the details, more or less. But this is historical, and everyone is talking about it, including Bill Bear.
That's me.
That's that. Even though he's imaginary, he's right there.
Yeah,
with the automation that I have seen in my career, I worked for a high-speed, high-volume printing company.
Okay.
And, you know, hundreds of thousands of mailers to customers another entity that contracts with us. They had cameras, and everything was barcoded, and the printers communicated with the computers. We could trace any individual letter to when it was printed and where was it in the stack of letters and the whole nine yards. It seemed to me that with that kind of automation that's currently available, that you could just take the cash, stick it in a machine, and it would go through and take track the serial numbers.
Yes.
You would think
tag it, and when they bag and tag it, all those denominations, they know basically the sequence, what's in the bag, you know, how much is in the bag, and where the bag is going to, so on and so forth. Yes, they do have that type of ID and that type of control.
Right, so that leaves
It's extremely difficult in today's age with technology, with cameras, right?
Yeah.
For them to get away with $30 million. It's crazy.
So it's a possibility that the money is directly traceable.
Might.
And if that's the case, and this crew obviously is well organized and highly skilled, they would need to launder the money.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not going to, you know, if that's the case, they probably have a broker who will take the hot cash and launder it for them. And they would get a portion back.
Yes. That's what I would do if I was still an active criminal, to make it more safe, because I would not trust it. I would not trust the denominations and the currency. I would change it for something else where I would be safe to spend it. I agree with you. 100%.
So I was telling Burl on the way over of a case of from 40 years ago, where a crew hit two armored transports. I don't remember it was Brinks, but the same concept.
Mm-hmm.
And there was $20 million in these two trucks. And it was, as I remember, it was a military installation. And there was just thousands of acres of empty land. And what the crew did is they spent a year and they built a bunker some distance away.
Genius.
And then they took the vehicles, disabled any tracking, took the vehicles into the bunker, cleaned up their tracks of them getting to the bunker, and stayed there for a year.
Wow.
They had power and facilities and a home, and they just...
Oh, yeah.
And then at the end of the year, they verified, they checked up and made sure no one was looking at night, and they drove off in a couple of trucks, never were seen from again.
That's how you do it.
And it was years later because of time, erosion, that kind of thing. Where the entrance was kind of uncovered, and that's when they found their lair.
I see. Still unsolved? Hmm?
So if they give this $30 million to an intermediary, what does the intermediary do with the money? How do they loan?
They get a percentage, you know, of the money. Now, I don't know what the going rate is, the exchange rate, you know, to launder money. But whatever it is, it's going to be a healthy return. This is a lot of money and a lot of currency. So, you know, they're going to be able to mask it as best as possible. Just there's a lot. And the best way is what Mark said, to launder it. That's the safest option. With the jewelry, that's actually easier for me because I would know how to melt down the gold. I would know how to take out the diamonds. And I would know how to resell it.
Break it down if it was an identifiable piece. You could take the parts out,
How to return on that value of the gold. And of the diamond prices. So it's very simple and easy. These guys, they pulled off a really intricate heist due to the size, due to $30 million. You know, it's a large number. But it was easy for them to go through the roof. It was easy for them to get to the money storage facility where they had this money. And the way that I would solve this case, if I was a working hack, is I would investigate everyone that had knowledge of the $30 million.
There had to be someone who knew, right? I mean, you don't have something like that happen without it being an inside job.
Well, if anybody ever told me, hey, Punch, I know where there's $30 million in a storage facility, you know, it's going to be there for this amount of time. And like as I said, it's going to have standard security, a camera, you know, CCTV footage, you know, whether a standard security system that's easily to combat, you know, if you're dealing with professionals. So, you know, these guys, they knew what they were doing. They somehow managed to enter the facility without setting off extra zones, and they got to the money pit, you know, to the money place where the money is, and they got to take the money out, and they started, this is the whole weekend. So they started March 31st, you know, and Easter Sunday, and by the time they came Monday, they were gone.
Yep.
Well, and nobody knew anything until they came Monday morning and they opened the facility where they stored the cash, and it was gone. Nothing was there.
Oiga vault, they say. Oiga vault. Where's the money? But I mean, in your brilliant book, Stealing Manhattan, you talk about you have a 3-day weekend, you have a holiday weekend. That's when you worked your butt off.
Exactly like this. The same scenario, the same type of, you know, storage facility. This is done by, they have Dunbar, you have Guardia, you got Ferrari Express, you have a bunch of, you know, places that store money. These are privately owned companies that, you know, take on these tasks to transport large amounts of money, and they're insured. So, you know, they hold the money in facilities, and they charge a very small fee. I don't understand how it's profitable for these companies to stay alive. But, you know, they're guarding $30 million. So somebody that knew something about them guarding the $30 million obviously alerted a crew of thieves, such as the one that I had, right?
Right.
In my circle, and they got to it. And Easter Sunday, you know, these guys, they hit lottery tickets because, you know, $30 million is a nice chunk of change to split. And I'm very curious the way this is going to pan out and see if it goes unsolved.
Now, let's suppose that we did this. Say you, Bark, and I had a couple of our buddies, whatever. We planned this, okay. And you planned it for us, and we all had a little part to play. And we did it. We just walked out with the $30 million, and we're sitting here now, and we're taking it to Mr. Fence down the street. And I don't know what he's going to do with it, but he's going to pay us money, right?
Yeah, maybe some accounts.
I would take a very small amount of that money just to move around, and I would bury it. I would put it somewhere. I would get out the country. I would want to, detach myself away from the money for some time and somehow geniusly not get caught. Changing the money.
Yeah, change it somehow.
Because you just got away with the most intricate, heist of the century. And it's the largest. It beats every other heist because it's a cash amount, it's a cash value. So when you're talking about $30 million, not too many heists get comparable to something of cash value, So these guys got cash money to burn. And I'm sure that there's money there that they can use that's not, entered in any type of database. I'm sure there's something there, coins or who knows? Who knows what was there? I don't know, but they said approximately $30+ million. So these guys had fun. Nobody got hurt. Oh, that's your favorite. Nobody got hurt. These guys, they woke up Monday, and they're missing a big amount of money. Nobody knows how they did it except Punch.
That's right. You've been there, done that.
Yeah, I respect these guys. I take my hat off, and I'm kind of jealous. I'm kind of jealous and envious that they pulled off a really insane historical heist that every mobster, every criminal would love to entertain, to be part of, because it has so much history. And on the totem pole, doing a heist is the epitome of
everything. Yeah, that's the top, the most respected criminal, because there's no violence, no one gets hurt. These people, obviously, were heavily insured.
Heavily.
So they'll say, it's a victimless crime. No. The insurance company's going to give them full retail value.
And then everyone's insurance goes up.
Everybody's insurance goes up. That's one thing that's going to happen regardless. But something? I do like the way they did it without anyone getting hurt. And that's the way, if you do something, you do it like that. So
like a mensch.
Look, it's respectable. I'm curious to see how it turns out. I know it has a heavy Spanish influence. Okay, being that it comes from Fernando Valley, I think that it has certain ties and motives, but it's going to be historical for Hollywood. They're making movies, and I hope they continue to call me as an expert to talk more about this, because they came in through the roof, and that's one of my specialties, going in through the roof, getting into the facility, entering a vault, a safe, or a money depot.
Well, when I saw this article right after Easter morning, my first thought was, oh my God, somebody read Stealing Manhattan? Pepper Punch.
That's the thing. This is as real as it gets, folks. I was surprised, and I'm kind of glad that there are security cameras on me at all times, especially during Easter.
It wasn't me this time.
Yeah, it wasn't me. And thank God that I have that opportunity to claim my innocence. But these guys, they pulled off a sensational heist, and there's a lot of video surveillance that they somehow evaded, and they got past, and which is mind-boggling to me. And they must have did their homework, and they executed fast, because, as I said, it's the people that know about the $30 million. How many people would actively know that the money was going to be in the facility at that time.
And probably someone who retired a week before and left the country.
I'm telling you, this has ties. This has outside ties for some reason. It has some type of, like, I told you, it has a Latin flavor to it. Meaning, I think, like, the guys that did the burglary, they were, like, maybe Mexican descent, South American descent, you know? Mm-hmm. I don't think it's the Pink Panthers. I don't think it's Italians, which Italians are very well known for doing something like this. Also, there's another character in social media and on YouTube. His name is Louis Ferranti, and he rewrote the LCN, La Cosa Nostra, a whole entire historic, you know, the whole history of how the La Cosa Nostra started. And it's called The Bordada. So I'm plugging his book. At the same token, I'm going to plug Steel in Manhattan because it's probably the best heist book, part one, that anybody could ever dive into. And it has all these tones of, you know, San Fernando Valley, the $30 million heist. The same way we did heist is the exact same way that this was pulled off. So it has very similar ways. Like, it looks like it was done by our crew, basically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's why I thought, my God, someone read Stealing Manhattan and copied what you did.
Exactly. And you know how many phone calls I've gotten that as soon as people heard about this, when it came out in the news, Monday, people started calling me like, "Hey, Punch, is that you? Is that you? Oh my God!" Like, you know, and I'm like, "No, of course not. I'm over here, guys. Come on. I told you, I'm really tired and buy the book, you know." And as I said, I relive my heist through the book, you know, through the story of Stealing Manhattan. And that's how, you know, I get my memories, you know, always intact and on paper. And Bob Bear did a tremendous job,
you know,
of putting all this to life. And, yeah.
Well, that's the other one was the Metro heist.
The Metro heist?
They had the 30-year anniversary in the paper. Yeah. They said, "We still don't know how they did it." I said, in the book, I said, "Send them a copy of this book."
Yeah, the moth. The moth had something to do with that heist. The moth, and I think my father beat a couple other guys.
Yeah.
As I said, you know, the things that my dad did and what he started is tremendous because it has a lot of European ties, you know, a lot of French guys.
Bruno Sulak.
You know, yeah, these criminals that are gentlemen criminals and very different than what they do today. And I just, you know, I'm glad that there was something like that existed, and they make wonderful movies about and stories about this. So, hey, I think Matthew Berkowitz is breaking through because
yeah.
He has a lot of eyes on this project and big names. So we're continuing to push the ball, and hopefully we see something you know, on network TV, something scripted, something, you know, on Netflix, something on HBO. We have a full agenda.
He's very excited about it. The Matthew Berkowitz, yeah. We call him Son of Cinema, is what Howard Lapidus called him.
Well, he's from New York, and he understands he has his finger on the vibration of New York. He knows that this is a New York story. It's a born and generated New York story, and it has those elements. So,
yeah, talked to him the other day, and I said, "Listen, I said, start doing interviews, get us together to do interviews while most of these people are still alive. You know, I mean, you're young, but there's other people who can, you know, testify to these stories that were involved that are getting up there in years."
Yeah, there's definitely people that we should, you know, put on video and get their content before, you know, while they're still here. Because as I said, life is short, life is grand. Be a big Bull fan and buy a book.
Yeah.
And,
this is top of mind stuff now. This is why I wanted to get you on the show today, because everyone's talking about this heist. And I'm going, man, this is Punch. Rick got Punch written all over it, you know?
Yeah. So you're going to see me on a bunch of things. I did a bunch of platforms already. I signed a bunch of non-disclosure agreements to do some documentaries talking about the San Fernando heist. So, yeah, as I said, it's they're using me as an expert voice for it, and I'm having a great time, commenting and talking about it. So So I think our friend Seth Ferranti is coming next week. He's coming down to Florida. And we're probably going to engage in some stuff that we found, this wonderful Cuban love story.
Ooh.
Jewish Cuban love story. So it has roots from Russia, but they're Cubans that escaped to Puerto Rico.
Whoa.
Just like the Goya family. So we're going to engage in a bunch of other documentaries. And
hey, I love Seth. We've had him on the show a couple of times. He's a great guest. Great guy.
Yeah.
And I like talking to him. He's a cool dude.
And then we have New York Connection. We still have Layer Cake. You know, Sean Sullivan, artist extraordinaire in New York, doing big things. And hopefully they can connect together with, he can connect together with Matthew Berkowitz and get all the content together in one week, you know? And
Of course, then I'll come out there and we'll all play together and have a wonderful time.
Oh, love.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm eager to see your mom again. She's a hottie.
Well, you know what? I would like to see us in New York soon. If not in New York, then maybe Miami, you know, or South Florida.
Hey, the other thing I'd like to do, Punch, is when we get to New York, you're always saying that you stash some stuff, you know, in the buildings there in the Diamond District. Yeah. Either someone found some of that stuff you stash, or it's sitting there waiting for us.
Well, you know what? It's not going to be boring, I'll tell you that much.
When we get together, we have a hell of a good time.
We definitely turn heads, you know, because people, they see that you actually like what we do, and you have a lot of fun doing it, and that's what I think. I think that hits the nail on the head when it comes to love what you do as your job, and that's it. That's the magic trick. That's what's going to bring you longevity.
You know, it's said that the average American guy will spend more time picking out a tie than he will picking out a career.
Yeah, I agree. That's a good one.
If you do what you love, if you really enjoy it, even if it's broadcasting, it's bad how you can attest.
Or stealing $30 million.
Or stealing $30 million.
Yeah.
See, the great thing about your dad and his crew and you and your crew as opposed to MoMA and a few other people is that you had a good time and you didn't kill each other fighting over the money. You didn't have to do it for the money. You gave a lot of money to charity and to help the community, help people start their real estate companies, etc. Totally different than the mob criminals who were greedy.
Yeah, unfortunately, there's a lot of greedy characters, and my father was extremely generous, and I really wish that he was back with us, and I really wish that he was here to enjoy, you know, the next level of where the story is going, you know, because as I said, his story is so astronomical and sensational that they don't make guys like that anymore.
No.
So generous with their money. And I learned a lot by being my father's son. And, you know, I'm that way. I'm still the same way. I'm extremely generous. So I hope to God that, you know, we break some eggs while we're making these movies and we can really give back and bring that type of feeling back.
I really found that so impressive about your father. I mean, here's a guy who was traumatized. I mean, traumatized as a kid.
Thank you.
And he lived with that trauma the rest of his life. And in fact, I think I detailed in the book how many traumas he'd been through. And he didn't want you to be traumatized, so he figured if he could traumatize you, it's like a boy named Sue. If you can deal with me, you can deal with anything, kid.
Exactly. He's a master operator, and he definitely knew exactly what he was doing. He had the command and respect of so many people in New York that were important, and he had a lot of respect by guys that, when you mentioned in the book, it sounds like unreal. But when we talk about guys like John Gotti, you know what? Mr. Stern brought John Gotti to Dubrovnik restaurant. There's not many people that brought John Gotti to a restaurant. So these are true little stories that actually happened, you know. He had a relationship with John Gotti, which is amazing, you know, for a non-Italian businessman, you know, so that stands out. And the fact that he did a heist with John Gotti.
Oh, I know. I've had people say, that's an incredible story. Gotti wanted to do a heist. And who does he bring to the heist? He thinks an alarm expert. It's Joe Coffey, who's a cop.
There's Lieutenant Joe Coffey that he unfortunately passed away a few years ago. But that's another character that we missed to interview and to talk about because the moth ran away. This is a true story that happened. And this diamond heist was somewhere in, I don't know, in the 30s, you know, in Manhattan. And John Gotti had two garbage trucks, had 20 guys working, and they shut down the, you know, Fifth Avenue.
He turned off all the power in the federal building.
It was crazy. The amount of power that John had, but what was he chasing? He was chasing the $30 billion heist. Okay, the same thing that happened in San Fernando Valley is what these wise guys, what they worship and what they cherish because it makes a good story. Because when we're at the bar and I'm talking about how I pulled off a $20 million heist, you know, people listen. They like that. It's entertaining. Yeah. You know, it makes movies. It makes Goodfellas was about the Lufthansa heist. Okay?
Yeah.
That's what Goodfellas guys from Queens. Okay, that Jimmy Burke, that was half Italian, half Irish, that grew up on the streets of Queens and Manhattan and Brooklyn, you know, West Side. He pulled off this heist. He's the mastermind. How did he find it? He found it through guys that were working in the airports that used to come to the bar, you know, and run their big mouths because they had debts from gambling or drugs or who the hell knows what. But they had vices. And information like that goes from the bottom to the top. And we all know that Maury, remember wigs? Maury's wigs from Goodfellas?
Yeah.
Maury's wigs don't come off in the wings. I don't know if you know the character, but he was always after Jimmy Burke, you know, after the money for the Lufthansa heist, and he never got it. What did he get? He got a ice pick behind his neck.
Yeah.
You know? And that's what guys get. You know?
Well, Burke was... Paranoid. You mentioned that, you know, what you would do is divorce yourself from the cash until things cooled off. And Jimmy told the crew that did the heist, no big stuff.
But
goat. and a Cadillac.
Yeah.
You know.
I told you not to do that.
You know, no big stuff. No big stuff.
No big stuff. Don't draw the
ink. The cops are outside watching. And that was the impetus for Jimmy to get rid of everyone involved.
I remember I was talking to Alex Krubeck. Is that how you pronounce his last name? And after you did the Miracle Watch heist, which you got busted on, and he went by there and they said, this, were you involved? Which he wasn't. But I thought that was interesting that someone accused him of being involved in the Miracle Watch heist. Are you there? Did we lose you again? Hello, Punch. Earth to Punch. I think we lost him. Yeah, did you see him? I think we lost him.
Is he imaginary, too?
No, he's not imaginary. He's real. He's very real. And there'll be a volume, too, of Stealing Manhattan once you folks all buy volume one. And I think once the Matthew Berkowitz puts together this thing with one of the streaming services, it'll help. But if you're into heists, I'll tell you, this is the ultimate heist book, thanks to Punch Stanimirovic and his family and his lovely mom and the people who were in his crew who participated and gave us the exclusive interviews. We could talk about it. Statute of Limitations was up on all those crimes, and he's retired. And he's, as he said, the reason there's no Pink Panther heist in the United States is because I retired. And his dad retired in, what, 2003? And his dad never got busted, never went to prison. Got away with everything. Except he got robbed. Problem with, we talked about this before, Mark, about when we had various other people out who made a lot of money in crime, and where's the money? You know,
well, they spent it.
You know, either they spent the money or they got it robbed from them. And the thing is, like, you can't be out spending all that money. It's like with Cain Jurel and Michael Dowd. You know, here they're all being corrupt as hell and driving fancy cars and buying their wives fancy houses. How are they doing that on $13,000 a year cop salary?
Or the classic scene in Superman 3.
Oh, with...
where they're discussing, okay, so who stole all the money? And somebody says, well, no one's going to drive in here with a $250,000 sports car. And right outside the window, no. Here comes Richard Pryor. $250,000
sports car. Well, I just rounded up the dollar. Someone actually did that, you know.
Yes, I know. I caught one.
They caught you?
No, I caught one.
Oh, you caught one?
Yes, husband and wife.
A husband and wife team, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, skimming the fourth and fifth decimal point in an interest calc and rolling it into random rolling accounts.
Well, that was smart of him. How long did they get away with that?
2.5 years.
Now, my brother...
And they were just dismissed.
And that's about all they do.
The offending...
There was a woman working for First Interstate Bank who was doing something very similar and putting all the money into like a hidden account. Took a vacation for like 10 years. Finally, she figured, okay, she went on vacation. They brought in a temp worker. And by accident, by God's grace, she happens to accidentally hit a combination of keys on the keyboard. She puts her fingers on the keyboard and bang, that was the exact combination of keys that opened that screen. And she goes, what the hell is this? Well, she and her family landed in Hawaii on the vacation. The feds were there to arrest her.
Yeah. It's human nature to trust. And large corporations trust. They have to have some level of that to operate. And then it's also human nature to take advantage of any loopholes you find, you know, in a system. And one of the loopholes that I helped uncover was if you go, you can get traveler's checks from a bank. You can get a cashier's check. You can get a bank draft. And the system would generate the next sequential number for the check, and then it would print the check at the branch. They'd print it out and hand it to the customer. Well, there was nothing in the system at the time that prevented duplicate checks. If something was wrong with the check, they would void it, issue a new one. And then they would enter the voided check back into the system so that it would balance out. And this one enterprising young lady would just, whenever one of these things would come along, she would go to somebody else's station and issue the same check for the same amount.
How long did she get away with this?
About 7.5 months.
And then, where is she now? Probably just got fired.
This particular instance was prosecuted because it wasn't newsworthy. Now, the individuals that ran off with all of this accumulative interest calc, that was a significant sum of money. And it was newsworthy, so that's why.
So they didn't get prosecuted. You don't want to freak people out by having them know about it.
Right, yes. Yeah. So we had to go and modify the system so that you couldn't reissue a previous number check. We had the...
Loans, those must be large rats.
The loans system, and you had the checking and savings. And as in any large corporation, there was no love lost between the two departments. And the savings and checking system, the tellers had in a little application were accustomed to come in and pay their mortgage. But it failed, so over 75% of the time it didn't work. And you had to get the mortgage amount owed exactly right. So what the tellers would do is they would enter some just horrible string of digits, all ones, all twos, you know, 1 through 9, 9 through 1, all zero, that kind of crap. The system would say, oh, that's an invalid number. The customer owes X. Would be the message back, and then they would know. Fast forward to new management that says, you know, you have to provide a mortgage interface from the perspective that works all the time. So months and months and months of work and getting all the pieces together, and we test the crap out of it, and everybody's happy. But no one was aware of the deliberate error entry that they tellers would do because of the port.
Oh.
It would just get a response, I'm sorry, this is an invalid amount. The customer owes X. So we deploy. But we didn't tell the tellers that it now works and you don't have to do anything. Just here's your new system. And it's like a week or so later, and I get called in, and, you know, okay, what's going on here, Mark? Well, I know. Well, this person, we owe this person $128
million. What the hell's going on? $128
million? Well, if you enter nine ones or nine nines, yeah. So I went through the logs and produced a report, and we saw the pattern of all these bizarre and going, and they're saying, well, we need to contact security and internal, you know, all this. And I said, no, you don't. No one is that freaking stupid. This is something else. And so management got a hold of the branches and asked these questions. Okay, why would they do that? Oh, we did it because X, Y, and Z. So we had to go and figure out what was owed, what they actually gave the teller, and then reverse the payment to put their account back in order. And it was a nightmare because all of the customers that had these huge numbers entered, their mortgage was made clear. And in some cases, a reconveyance was on the way.
I got into a thing with Cash App the other day. No matter how often I explained to them what happened, they still couldn't comprehend it. You could comprehend this. Our listeners are smart enough to comprehend this. Someone hacked both my bank account and my Cash App account simultaneously. Transferred money from my bank account to my Cash App, and then from my Cash App to them. I realized what transpired. Notified the bank this transfer was fraudulent, and I notified Cash App, this payment's fraudulent. The bank pulls the money back. Does Cash App pull the money back? No. I said, look, the bank pulled the money back because it was a fraudulent transfer. The money went to these people. They got the money. You should pull it back. You should contact your bank. They pulled the money out. No. This has been going on for like a year. I've been trying to explain this to them. Do you follow the sequence of events? Nope, sorry.
Yeah, people don't think. My mother was starting to lose her cognitive facilities.
Yeah.
We applied for Medi-Cal to help with what we were expecting to have to pay for assisted living.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to fill all the paperwork out. Now, all of the assets, our parents' assets, was in a trust. So Medi-Cal couldn't touch it. Because Medi-Cal will take all of your money, everything, your house, your car, whatever you got, they will take everything they can get their hands on and use that to pay your claims. So we filled everything out, got our trust attorney involved, the paperwork. We sent the paperwork in, and a couple of weeks later, we got a letter back denying our request and asking why we didn't declare this several billion dollars in assets.
Hello?
And my sister was freaking out. She was just all like, ah. And I took one look at my, I'm on the floor laughing my ass off. The account they referenced, that the Social Security number was not a Social Security number, it was a 10.
A what?
A 10, TIN, tax identification number.
Oh.
Starting 95 dash. That's a California corporate tax identification.
Right.
And I looked at that and I just started laughing. I recognized it. Because I spent many years in the wire room at Home Savings. That's an entirely different story of security. Because that was how you moved money then, you know, in the 70s and 80s. There was no direct, ACH was there, but it wasn't like it is now.
So what were you laughing about? What was these billions of dollars?
Oh, it was the capital reserve that the SNL were required.
So they thought that was your money, huh?
Right. So I took the letter and I sent a note to our CEO. And he got me in touch with general counsel. And I got a note. You know, my boss comes, why does the general counsel want to talk to you? And I said, oh, it's this letter from Medi-Cal and they want to know why we didn't report the money that this institution holds. Oh, and I said, if you want to come and make sure everything's okay, you can come with me. And so we went. We were in the Baldwin Park Business Center. It's a big complex. I think the City of Hope is now there now. Beautiful complex. We went to the office. He goes, what is it? And I said, you know, this is the letter we got back from Medi-Cal. And he goes, well, why do you want me? And he said, well, let's just say that when I looked at it, I was on the floor laughing for half an hour. So he looks at it, and he reads it, and puts it down and looking at me. I get this huge, you know, S-eating grin on my face. What are you doing? You know, he reads it and reads it, and then hits him. And he starts laughing, too. He says, I will have a letter for you by end of day. Thank you for coming in. So, do you need a copy of this? I'll just hang on to this and return it. So, I got a letter from the general counsel, and then we sent that back into Medi-Cal, you know, apologizing for any misunderstanding. Yeah, but they wanted to know why my mom had a couple of billion dollars in assets. You don't know the difference between a Social Security number and a corporate tax identification number.
Well, they apparently were well-educated in the road industry.
Any corporate entity will have an EIN and a TIN.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And we had to, you know, any trust. If you have a personal trust, you'll have an EIN. And those are easy to set up. You go to the website, type your information in, enter the name of the trust exactly as it is on the mm-hmm. paperwork, and you'll get a note. You print it, and there you go. Nothing special.
But
that's a shame. We punch dropped off.
Yeah. He probably was trying to call back in, probably getting a business signal because he's still connected or something.
No, it's okay because we're almost done.
We're almost done. Thank you, Punch, for your expertise. If you ever want to know anything about how to do a brilliant heist, ask Punch
or
buy the book.
Stealing
Manhattan from Wild Blue Press by Punch Stadimirovic and the legendary Burl Bear.
So how far along are you on volume two?
Well, I haven't started typing yet. Punch has been making notes and picks up from, well, volume one ends with him deciding he's not going to be a crook anymore. He's going to get a real job. And he does get a real job. And then they find out, puts in his real Social Security number, and they come and they drag him out of the place in handcuffs. He hasn't done anything wrong. Anyway, but they know who he used to be. And they figure he's there, he's going to rip him off. He cried. He actually cried. Because here he went straight. He gets married. He's got a nice home on Long Island.
He's unpunished, bro.
He says, how are you supposed to be a reformed criminal if they fire you when they find out what you used to do? So he decided, well, I'll show them. And so he decides to do some even more bizarre, daring, and creative crimes of intelligence, of ripping off the overinsured. never hurt any individuals.
Do we have a guest for next week?
We certainly will have a guest next week. I found a guest I want to have on that I just found out about yesterday. And I'll tell you about that in our spare time. And that'll be fascinating. I guarantee you. She doesn't know I'm going to have her on yet, but I'm going to give Leonard Bushell, who turned me on to this person yesterday. And this is going to be a great story. And days and years, and then we'll publish the book that shows it was Denison all along. How about that?
That is excellent. What's the title of this tome?
The working title is To Live and Lie in L.A.
a play on a great movie.
Yes.
By
what's his name?
Oh, geez. He was on CSI Las Vegas.
The actor. Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, that's a great movie.
And what's his name is in it, too?
Live and Die in L.A.
Yeah.
And we all hate the ending because we didn't want him to die. William Peterson.
Really? How is William doing?
He came back to do some of the reincarnation of CSI Las Vegas.
Oh, well, how about that?
But he also did the first introduction to Hannibal Lecter.
Oh, that's true. Manhunter.
Michael Mann, that was a...
I get my recommendation on Netflix, The Tourist.
Netflix,
two seasons
sir.
On Netflix, The Tourist. Excellent series, excellent. Okay. What's next?
Hey, Pearl.